More than 6 million Americans have been out of work for at least 6 months. Hunting for a new job can be a demoralizing process, the resumes, the cold calls, but there are strategies that work. Here's NPR's Wendy Kaufman with some tips.
Matt Youngquist, the president of Career Horizons, sees lots of people who've lost their job. He tells them finding a job presents the same challenges as taking a product to market, but the product they're marketing is themselves.
First, you got to know what you're selling and to whom. Then you've got to package it up properly. Then you get into kind of that execution phase.
Los Angeles area resident Terry Garfinkel didn't waste much time after being let go from her job at a high-end retail bakery. She cried, drove home, and then opened her laptop.
And the first thing I did was check my employer files, and I keep pretty good records of everywhere I've worked. And I went through the list and sent out emails to any of my ex-employers I felt I would want to work for again and let them know that I was available and looking.
Her effort paid off. She was hired for a direct sales job by someone she had worked for just briefly a decade ago. Most people still hunt for jobs primarily by looking at the posted offerings. Websites like Indeed.com and Simply Hired make searching easier. But just sending out resumes, even hundreds of resumes in response to ads, probably won't get you very far. Because, as career coach Matt Youngquist explains, most jobs aren't posted or advertised publicly.
At least 70%, if not 80% of jobs are not published. And yet most people, they're spending 70 or 80% of their time surfing the net versus getting out there, talking to employers, taking some chances, realizing that the vast majority of hiring is friends and acquaintances hiring other trusted friends and acquaintances.
But what if you don't know anyone who works in a company you're interested in? Youngquist suggests using the people search page on the networking site LinkedIn to find people who could put you in touch with a hiring manager. That personal connection is especially important now. With so many people applying for jobs, it's hard to get noticed. How hard? We asked Ashley Stirrup.
You typically see about six times the number of applications as you have employees in a company. So for a 30,000 employee company, that would be 180,000 applications a year.
That's right. 180,000 applicants. Stirrup isn't making these numbers up. The company he works for, Taleo, is a leading provider of software that companies use to sift through job applications.
I remember it was a kind of an intimidating scene.
Former pharmaceutical sales rep Camilo Ruan recalls one third round interview he had last year. He was on one side of a hotel conference room table. Several of the firm's hiring managers were on the other.
And I just remember looking at the stack of resumes, and it was about 60, 70 resumes that they had on there, and they had, two positions open.
He didn't get that job, but landed what he describes as a great one as an account executive at the international package delivery company TNT Express. He even makes more money now than he did before.
I would say the smartest thing that I did was look at the job hunt as the job itself.
He'd get up early and every day make 6, 7, even 8 contacts, phone calls, customized emails with resumes and cover letters that focused not on past performance but on the future. He used his knowledge of a company and its products to highlight what he could do for them. And yes, job seekers, cover letters do matter. As for how many contacts a job seeker should be making, Youngquist says 100 a month is a bare minimum.
It takes X number of contacts to get this many appointments, to get this many chances of actually getting a sales opportunity or a job. I do think volume is a big part of it, and a lot of people, their efforts are just really anemic.
And he adds, there are more jobs out there than many people think, but you have to be smart and disciplined about finding them. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Next, we go to Chicago for a story on what you could call snow futures. They are financial contracts based on the level of snowfall. Companies trade them in the hopes of softening the blow that a big blizzard might have on their business. Here's Nyla Boodoo of Midwest Reporting Project, Changing Gears.
The old-fashioned way to deal with record snowfall usually involves shovels, plows, or snowblowers. But former Maryland's trader Jeff Hodgson had another idea.
Wow, this is a storm that I didn't foresee coming, and I just lost a lot of money on my business, or maybe I could have made more money.
That's right. His idea was to create a hedging business for snowstorms. So Hodgson started the Chicago Weather Brokerage in 2009 to help connect companies that want to hedge their bets on how the weather affects their bottom line. He did this by helping the CME Group create a financial market based on snowfall. They're actually called snow derivatives. So here's how it works. The average snowfall for winter in Chicago is around 37 inches. So the contracts are like insurance, paying out a set amount of money for every inch over or under, depending on what kind of contract you take out.
Everybody kind of says, well, you can control everything but the weather.
That's the Chicago Mercantile's Tim Andreessen.
Well, we can't control the weather, but we can help you mitigate the risk of the weather on your business.
These snow contracts are based on official airport snowfall tallies at Chicago's O'Hare, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Detroit, and Boston, as well as New York's LaGuardia and in Central Park. Andreessen says contract holders range from road salt manufacturers and property managers to snow removal contractors and airlines.
Our products would allow people to hedge against that extra cost of having to deal with the weather.
The snow contracts trade until March. Then the Chicago Weather Brokerage shifts to its newest market, hedging rainfall. For NPR News, I'm Nyla Boodoo in Chicago.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The unemployment rate in the U.S. has fallen to 9%. That's the word today from the Labor Department. It's the second month in a row that the unemployment rate has tumbled, which might sound encouraging, but at the same time, job growth in January was anemic. Here's NPR's Chris Arnold to explain the mixed signals.
The U.S. has lost more than 8 million jobs since 2007. And the Labor Department says last month it gained only 36,000 of those jobs back. So that's really nothing. But here's what's surprising and confusing. The unemployment rate is falling sharply anyway.
Well, it's enough to make anyone's head spin. Is it good news? Is it bad news in today's report?
Lisa Lynch is a dean at Brandeis University and a former chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor.
Certainly the drop in the unemployment rate down to 9% is very good news.
Lynch thinks that trend is real. And as far as the unexpectedly small new jobs number,
that reflected in part some fluky issues in the employment numbers when the data were collected. They were collected in a week in January when we had a lot of severe weather across the country.
There was ice in the south, floods in the west, snowstorms seemingly everywhere else. So Lynch says when you look at the industries where people work indoors, the report actually looks pretty good. Take manufacturing of everything from computers to cars to different kinds of metals.
We saw over 60,000 jobs added in the economy, and that's terrific. These are well-paying jobs, more skilled jobs, and that's a sign of hope going forward.
But when you look at people who work outdoors, doing construction or shipping and delivering packages, fewer people were able to work. And Lynch says that probably skewed the numbers. For example, you have to be really dedicated to want to work as a bike messenger in a blizzard.
So those just look like kind of regular baldish city tires. I mean, can you stay up in the snow on those?
Oh, they sort of cut through all the snow and go right down to the road surface.
On the street in Boston, bike messenger Graham Conway is riding slowly down the sidewalk to talk to me. Graham is 23. He's wearing wet sneakers with wool socks, and he's been making deliveries and dodging obstacles that could send him flying off his bike into traffic.
Inattentive cab drivers and like wet manhole covers in the road.
Yeah, well, you know, the snow's coming in on Saturday night.
Inside the offices of Breakaway Courier in downtown Boston, Tom Cronwell is one of the owners. He's calling orders over to his dispatchers.
Hey, Vinny?
Yo.
That's Rich. He just has a pickup at their office in Andover going to Lynn.
The delivery business is actually an interesting one to look at because you can see firsthand the different ways that the economy is slowly picking up steam again. Cromwell says, for example, restaurants are doing more business, so his drivers pick up more crates of fresh fish at the airport.
Logan Airport, a couple times a week when they catch it. It's day boat fish from Florida. And it seems like the legal and the financial industries are a lot busier now. I got to just grab this call. Johnny. You just dropped off the nebulizer. That's good.
The company's also been delivering medical gear to asthma patients at their homes. That's turned into a pretty steady source of work. And back before this past month with all the crazy weather, the pickup in business led Cromwell here to hire on more people.
You know, I would think we picked up 5 or 6 full-time couriers.
But it's going to take a lot more companies all over the country hiring a lot more people to keep bringing down the unemployment rate. At 9%, it hasn't been that high for so long since 1948 when the data started being collected. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
For more on today's jobs numbers, we're joined by Austin Goolsbee. He's chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. He also helped unveil today what the government is calling its strategy for American innovation. Mr. Goolsbee, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Michelle.
Now, before we talk innovation, we should spend some time talking about those jobs numbers, 36,000 net new jobs. And we as a country need to create 3 or 4 times that just to keep up with population growth. Can the White House create jobs? Do you have the power to do that, or is that something that's really left best to the business community?
Well, I think the private sector has clearly got to be the main driver of long-term job creation in the country. We're coming out of a stage in which the private sector was in free fall and we were in rescue mode. But we are exiting that stage. We are now at a stage where there is money that has been accumulated on the sidelines. You've started to see an upturn in business investment. That the policy response to that shift is let us pass policies like the president's tax deal, which give incentives for the private sector to stand up, but really we are now shifting to where it ought to be, the private sector doing the revving of the engine.
Can you quickly walk us through the basics of this strategy for American innovation? What will drive that?
Well, I'd say the key building blocks of an innovation strategy are educating your population, doing research and development, building the infrastructure that your industry needs to grow, and then on top of that foundation, orienting around the private sector through small business, encouraging startups, and then some reform of the patent system so that inventors don't have to wait literally 3 years to get their applications approved, that we get that time down substantially to allow smaller inventors to get to market quicker, focus on clean energy and some other national priorities. That's in some sense the pyramid of innovation, that there are these baseline building blocks, but then we also have this orientation to the private market.
The word innovation, I just have to ask you about something, because I'm thinking about people I have met and traveling around the country, and the word innovation, what that sometimes means to people who are in jobs, they have a certain worry when they hear that term, that it means that they might be replaced with someone who's younger or faster or replaced by a machine.
Well, I certainly hope that it doesn't get that implication. When we say innovation, I think what we mean is creating new ideas and new products and things that can be built in America and they can be sold around the world or they can be sold here at home, that the people making it will be getting higher pay and higher productivity and making America a more competitive place to do business.
I have one last question for you, Mr. Goolsbee. You don't strike me as a pessimistic man, but I wonder when we listen to the president talk about America being facing this sort of Sputnik moment, what worries you? What keeps you up at night? Which country or what entity might overtake us if we don't get this right?
You know, the competitiveness is of our companies and of our workers. So it doesn't have to be any one country. I mean, it's a lot of people talk about China, but I think it is worth noting we're 12 times richer than China, but we don't want to fall behind. We have always been the most productive, the best educated, the most innovative, with the most successful startups in the world. We can maintain that. What keeps me up at night is the long run nagging stuff that we know we've got to do to invest and be winning the future and keeping our people trained. That in the midst of the short-run battles, sometimes we can forget about those longer-run investments, and we really shouldn't.
Austin Goolsbee is the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Good to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
Oh, great to talk to you, Michelle.